For decades, we've discussed as to how we all need to take better care of the men and women who have served in our military. Today, let's get an update as to how that's going. Welcome to the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. We've all heard the comments. Our vets and their families need more support, especially when it comes to medical care. That's our focus today, assisting our vets. And we want to start the conversation by bringing in Robert Wilkie, the U.S. Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Secretary Wilkie, thank you for your time, sir.
Ron, thank you for having me.
How would you describe the current system for health care for veterans? Are you satisfied with what's in place now?
Well, let me tell you, I think the status of health care for veterans is much better than it has been in many years, and I'll give you an example. I just presented to the Congress a $220 billion budget. I'm a pariah in the cabinet room because I'm the only one who did not have to present budget cuts. It's the largest budget in the history of our department. It calls for 390,000 employees. And at the same time that we are moving ahead in areas like mental health, where that budget spends about $9.5 billion, spends another $1.1 billion on homelessness programs, we are putting in place the Mission Act. We kicked that legislation off last Thursday, and it opens the aperture when it comes to veterans having more access to health care in the communities where they live, and more importantly, particularly for those veterans in Connecticut and Long Island, the people whom you serve on public radio. This gives them what their neighbors have, and this gives them access to urgent care so that they no longer have to worry about coming into the emergency room when they have colds or fever or there's a sprain. They can go right to urgent care, and that puts them on a level playing field with those around them. So it was a big day last Thursday, and we're very happy with the progress.
Now, MISSION stands for Maintaining Internal Systems and Strengthening Integrated Outside Networks. I think MISSION is a lot easier to say.
That's right. Only the Congress would come up with that acronym. But, yes, so what that does, it says that if we do not have something that a veteran needs, let's just pick rheumatology, then we give the veteran the opportunity to go into the private sector and find that. Let me tell you what it isn't. It's not libertarianism at VA. It's not me giving a veteran a card that says veteran on it and then says go out and prosper. It does say that if we don't have a service that is accessible to you, then we give you the option of going in the private sector. One of the reasons that's important for the areas that you serve is it says in the Mission Act, and I've actually promulgated the regulations, that if you are 30 minutes away from a VA facility, more than 30 minutes away, we start giving you the opportunity to go into the private sector, because in your area of the country, using those old standards of the past, where it says you had to be a certain number of miles away. Well, you all know better. You could be 10 miles away from a VA facility in your area of America, and it's going to take you an hour to get there, just because of the traffic and the traffic pattern. So we've modernized this. It's a system that many veterans will be familiar with when they had TRICARE and CHAMPUS back in the 60s and 70s, so we're very happy with that.
So this, in effect, replaces the program that the Obama administration had in place.
Well, yes. Now, the CHOICE Act was passed and primarily through the efforts of Senator McCain in response to the tragedy in Phoenix. But I think if Senator McCain were sitting here, he probably would tell you that it was passed too hastily. It made demands on a system to reform itself in just a few short months that a system this size was not capable of doing. This is a more nuanced, this is a more level approach to reforming the institution, and I think last Thursday we saw that it can work.
So if I can simplify it a little bit, if you're a vet, if you're not feeling well, if something's wrong, you don't have to make the trek out to wherever. And if there's an urgent care facility nearby you, you can go. You can go there.
You can go there. That's exactly right. And unlike Choice, Ron, where they had seven different types of payment systems, we've now consolidated that into one. In the past, the private sector providers had no idea how they could participate and how they can how they would get paid. And this will not work unless we are providing those in the community with the financial support that's required for the services that they provide.
Mm. Secretary Wilkie, as you well know, some regional VA hospitals have had their share of problems over the years. Do you see this as a way to help them fix that?
Well, I think it's part of an entire program, Ron, that also deals with supply chain management, electronic health record. For the first time, young Americans who will enter the military will have an electronic health record that builds through their entire time in uniform, and then they are handed off to the VA. We are reforming the way we hire and retain people. Good thing is that the Journal of the American Medical Association in January said that our wait times for the four most important medical specialties, and that includes primary care and mental health, the wait times at VA are good or better than any in the private sector. So we are moving rapidly in that area, and the electronic health record and our new website will even make it easier for veterans to get their care when they need it.
Mm. Mr. Secretary, what do you hear when you speak with veterans? What are their main concerns and complaints?
Well, the one thing that I do hear, and it's something that I've said in testimony, is that they want VA. They don't want VA to go away. And as somebody who spent an entire life in and around the military from the day I was born, I understand probably as well as anybody who's been in this chair for a long time that veterans want to go where people speak the language and understand the culture. And I tell them that the privatization issue is really a sort of a politician's trick, in that if we're privatizing this institution, we're going about it in a really strange way. Because in 2008, our budget was $98 billion, and we had about 280,000 employees. And today, that budget's $220 billion, and we're hitting about 390,000 employees in the next few months. So we're expanding the services.
Mm. Finally, can you tell us about the post-9/11 caregivers program?
Well, that is another part. First of all, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's another part of the Mission Act. But the post-9/11 caregivers program is already in place. And that says to the families of those who were serving after September 11, 2001, if they care for that veteran at home, then that veteran will get financial and resource support. But what Mission does is it opens that world up to my father's generation, still the largest number of veterans in this country, those who served in Southeast Asia in the 60s and the 70s. So that is something that we're very proud of. It's very important to me in that it closes one of the last loops left open from Vietnam, and that will start working that in October. But right now, those who served after September 11th meet eligibility requirements to have the folks who care for them at home supported.
Mm. We only have 1 minute left, and I hate to put you on the spot, but 5 years from now, what would you like the VA to look like?
Well, I want VA to look like a modern 21st century healthcare administration, Ron. That means we are adaptable to a generation of veterans who don't have to wait for care. They're computer savvy, and we reflect that change in the veterans population. I want us to be the world leader when it comes to, I think, the greatest unspoken medical issue in this country, and that's mental health. And I think by the time my children's children are around, we'll have turned the corner on cancer. We're not even at the Sputnik stage in mental health. And because of the unique nature of our business and the toll that service takes on young Americans in particular, I want us to be the world leader when it comes to mental health services.
Robert Wilkie, the U.S. Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. We appreciate your time.
Ron, thank you. And thank you for making sure that the veterans in Connecticut and Long Island are taken care of as well.
We just heard from the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Robert Wilkie. Now we're going to get the perspective a bit closer to home. David Green is with the Connecticut Veterans of Foreign Wars. He's the state commander. John Larenson is a member of the National VFW Legislative Committee. Gentlemen, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
You heard the interview with Secretary Wilkie. What do you think? David, can I start with you, please?
Yes. We've been going through the choice program and all that kind of stuff, and the VA is very strong with the relationship with the VA. And our national commander feels that I don't think that they talk too much with the VFW or other service organizations to put some input on how this affects veterans. What we don't want to see is, I mean, I can understand going out and traveling and stuff like that, but our concern is that we don't want to have the VA become obsolete and then eventually downsizing the VA where everybody else is going somewhere else, and then maybe eventually co-pays will be involved, things like that. There's a lot to it, and we feel that we should have been part of it. I mean, the VFW.
So if I can understand this correctly, you're actually concerned about privatization, that if the government backing of this were to disappear and it would simply go over to private doctors, private hospitals?
Yes, that's how I feel. Yes, sir.
Okay. John, can I have your perspective, please?
Some time ago, there was a Blue Ribbon Commission established to study the VA. And as Dave mentioned, veterans were not represented on the committee. It was all CEOs of existing healthcare companies. And their recommendation was to eliminate the VA. And we know, based on our experience, it's a lot of expertise within the VA that we would have lost if that had ever happened. I mean, you can't go anywhere for medical help for things like Agent Orange, or traumatic brain injuries, and get better care than you can get at the VA because they have this experience and this expertise on staff. So that's what we're trying to avoid. And as the secretary mentioned, this really goes back to 2014, when about 40 veterans died in Phoenix. They were on waiting lists, and that's pretty much been eliminated. There's been a number of bills, even prior to the Choice Act, that it improved many, many facets of the VA care. The Mission Act itself is a little more complex than just caring of veterans. There's actually five separate parts to this. Now, caring for veterans is only one part. And these various parts are more germane to Connecticut veterans, certain sections are, than other sections. There's a section in here about the, I think it's section, yes, 4, healthcare in underserved areas. This is really focused on the most sparsely populated states. There's 5. It's Alaska, it's North and South Dakota, it's Wyoming and Montana. And when the secretary talks about these 30-minute trips, that is just about impossible in those 5 states I've mentioned. So that's why that really isn't a big problem for Connecticut veterans, all right? But if you go on to Section 5, and it talks about other matters, and it says here it alters the definition of a major medical facility project from projects that exceed $10 million to projects that exceed $20 million. Now, that's where a lot of work has been done at the West Haven, Connecticut Hospital, is based on these projects. And by doubling the amount that's spent on these projects, Connecticut will get faster renovations done, and they'll get a more comprehensive renovations done. And this didn't happen by accident. There are representatives from Connecticut who've been writing letters about this, and we're now seeing the fruits of their efforts here.
Right. So,
when
I'm sorry, John. So it sounds as if you are pleased with the Mission Act.
There are parts of this that are absolutely great. It's not an all or nothing thing. As the secretary mentioned about the previous attempt at this called the Choice Act, it was not a total failure. It was not a total success. And that's why they came back with this version now, from what they've learned in the previous attempt, so that it would be a smoother operation. Reimbursement for the community-based providers was a major issue on that first go-round. And there's a lot of concern, or actually trepidation among, you know, have they ironed that all out, this interoperability between the systems so that people get paid? Only time will tell, Ron.
Mm-hmm.
David, can I go back to something that you had mentioned earlier? And that was that the veterans' thoughts were not requested. Your input was not taken. Why do you think that was?
I really don't know. I don't understand why not. I mean, we work with the VA a lot, and you know, with concerns for veterans. So it seemed like they didn't want to hear from any kind of service organization. And like John says, politicians came up with the ideas to do this and that without consulting, you know, other organizations to really feel, you know, get the insight of what the veteran feels, you know, wants. I mean, I'm personally, to be honest with you, the VA has been very good with me. They've upgraded a lot of their technology, and I've gotten service really good, and I'm very pleased with it. I know there's been issues with some veterans, but that happens. But they've upgraded a lot now. They have the new websites. You can order your prescriptions online now, and various things like that. So I'm pleased with the result of the VA and how they've changed a lot to upgrade and make it better for veterans. They really are concerned on veterans' health, I think.
You are listening to The Full Story on WSHU. I'm speaking with David Green, who you were just hearing. He is the state commander for the Connecticut Veterans of Foreign Wars, and John Larenson is a member of the National VFW Legislative Committee. John, same question for you, please. Why do you think that the input was not taken from the vets?
I have to give the same answer as Dave. I'm not certain. I do know that the Veterans of Foreign Wars made an extensive effort. They went out and did multiple surveys. They actually had people sitting in the waiting rooms at the various locations across the country speaking with the veterans who were there as patients. And they also mailed out a survey to veterans who are members of the Veterans of Foreign Wars and asked them what type of treatment they were getting at the VA and what needed to be improved. And I'll never forget this, 86% of the respondents were totally satisfied with the care they were getting from the VA. So in the eyes of the veterans in our organization, there is no need to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. It's a matter of tweaking the system and optimizing it.
All right, so with that in mind, what would be your number one tweak, if you will?
This urgent care that the commissioner mentioned, which is part of this Mission Care Act, can be a powerful aid to providing veterans care. Unfortunately, you know, the day that this last week actually became operative. I'm not aware that they had actually contracted with any urgent care providers in Connecticut yet, okay? They probably have contract negotiations going on with someone. But as far as I know, and David, you correct me if I'm wrong, I haven't seen a named actual facility where Connecticut veterans could go to for urgent care yet.
And I haven't either.
Hmm. Okay, gentlemen, while I have you, I'm just going to ask you one or two other questions. One of the major problems for veterans in the past was homelessness. John, what's the situation like nowadays?
There's definitely been more emphasis on eliminating homelessness for veterans, both at the state level and at the federal level. And it's not just lip service. There's funds being allocated. There's actual building going on. It seems like everyone realizes that homelessness is really caused by joblessness. So the cycle, it's a fatal cycle for veterans. First it's the joblessness, then it's the homelessness, then it's the suicide. And everyone's trying to impact and lower that suicide rate of 20 veterans a day. And they know that that's intertwined in this circle here.
David, I'm going to get your perspective also, but I do know the report came out the other year. And the report said, and if I have my numbers correct, I believe it was from 2008 to 2016, 6,000 vets a year were committing suicide. Those are shocking numbers.
Yes, they are.
David, what are your thoughts on that?
It's definitely improving, but not enough. We're putting in crisis line numbers at our local post. We hand out cards to let people know the five signs of facial expressions and demeanor. And I know other service organizations are doing the same thing because it is it's come down a little bit, but two, it used to be 22, now it's 20. It's still a big factor that the VFW is very concerned about.
Could I also ask your perspective, get your thoughts on the homeless situation?
That is another thing that we are all working on. I know in my community that they built a home for veterans. The American Legion did this. And what they did is in the area, anybody who's homeless is eligible to go to this facility for living quarters for a while. Then they have people coming in to give them information, try to get them back on their feet. And like John says, the jobs. The vet centers are trying to, you know, more. We need maybe some more vet centers that help veterans. And like John said, it's the biggest thing. But if they lose inspiration, they don't have a job. And, you know, it's definitely on the VFW's minds. And I go to Joe Courtney's meetings, and they have representatives there that talk about this all the time. And I know John does also. Anything that we can do to eliminate this. And we're going to continue to do that.
David, I have to ask, because you mentioned something that I had never heard of before. You said the five facial signs. What are the signs, the five facial signs?
It's basically, it's not only facial. I might have said that wrong. But what it is a sad face. You're saying, oh, how come you're so sad? You know, then they might do that. Or the mean face. Expressions, various things that you can, when you're talking to a veteran, and that's the first thing you ask them, how you doing, you know, is everything okay? And then it goes from there. And then they talk to you about, well, I'm down and out. And so we try to get them, you know, help that way. But we have cards that show expressions of faces on it, and it's just a card of signs to look for when you're talking to a fellow veteran or anyone, actually.
Yeah, I would say so. I think that would apply in many situations. Mm-hmm. John, going along this same line, how would you describe the mental health assistance that's currently available for vets?
It also is being ramped up, especially under the Mission Act. There's a significant incremental increase there as a part of this, $220 billion budget. And a portion of that is actually allocated for outside providers. So it's been included in the community care piece. There are some, hardcore issues at the VA. It actually takes about 12 months to hire a physician at the VA. So there are situations where you need this mental health, quickly. And sometimes the most rapid response is going outside of the VA for that mental health care.
Mm.
But they're funding for it now. And they're recognizing that the need is significant. And so I do anticipate it getting better.
John, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds, from what you're saying, like it's trending in the right direction.
I have to say it is. After being involved for 5 years, I've seen a significant improvement, even in my own personal care. I never had a large issue, a big thing with the VA, but they're actually, crossing the T's and dotting the I's in a manner that they didn't used to.
David, do you feel the same way?
Oh, definitely, yes. I've seen an improvement with response. They'll text me on my phone. No, don't forget you have an appointment. Let us know, yes or no. So, they've improved it that way. And I really do like the system that they have now where you don't have to call. You just go on your computer and your records are there. And you can order your medicine, and the prescription comes within a week. And I've had really good results from the VA, and I'm very happy that I got it because I didn't think I needed that. And when I was younger, I said I don't need the VA. But now that I'm retired and I have Social Security and the VA, I am really glad that I have it.
John Larenson, we have 30 seconds left. I'm going to give you the final word, please.
There's much work left to be done. There are bills in Congress that would eliminate the kid tax. The things like they're double taxing the survivors of of those who gave all for our country as a result of this tax act that changed in 2017 for the federal tax code. And I'm sure that was just a mistake. Someone overlooked the impact of that change in the taxes. But we have legislation in the pipeline, and we're getting lots of support for it. So I'm expecting that to pass in this 116th Congress.
John Larenson, member of the National VFW Legislative Committee. David Green with the Connecticut Veterans of Foreign Wars. He's the state commander. David, John, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
This is The Full Story. We'll be right back. This is The Full Story on WSHU, and we continue with our discussions about veterans, what they've done for us, the sacrifices made, and what kind of support they receive when they return home. We're going to call in someone who spent a good chunk of his time on Capitol Hill on this issue, the former congressman from New York's 2nd and then 3rd districts, Steve Israel. Mr. Israel, welcome. Thank you for your time today.
Ron, it's great to be with you.
When you were in Congress, you were a member of the Armed Services Committee and the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense. And with that perspective, what kind of care do you think that veterans are receiving nowadays?
Insufficient. We're making slow progress, but it really needs to be a national priority. I served in Congress for 16 years. Most of the work that I did in Congress focused on national security and veterans issues. And, you know, I would go, I'd been to Iraq and Afghanistan well over a dozen times, and would come back to the U.S. from those battlefield visits deeply concerned about our capacity and our national commitment to providing those warriors with the lifetime services that they require. Again, we're making a little bit of progress, but we have to go well beyond that. This should be a national priority that is bipartisan. Democrats and Republicans should agree to make this number one in terms of our resources, investments, and commitments.
So can we drill down on it a bit? Do you think more Sure. facilities, more doctors, more nurses? What do you think needs improvement?
Well, it spans a range of things. First, you know, we tend as political people, whether a member of Congress or the occupant of the Oval Office or in the Pentagon, we tend to make decisions to go to war without fully understanding the consequences. And we did that to an extreme extent when we went to Iraq. You know, we went in thinking, well, it's going to be easy. You know, they'll greet us as liberators. And not only was it hard, but we didn't really plan sufficiently for the lifetime consequences of those who returned with post-traumatic stress disorders, with injuries, with traumatic brain injuries, mild traumatic brain injuries, et cetera. So one thing we can do, I'll tell you where we can start, is simply ensuring that we calculate the long-term human and budget costs of decisions to go to war before we go to war. That's number one. Number two, we built the Veterans Administration at another time when budgets weren't as strained as they are, when our politics was different, and we haven't sufficiently modernized the VA. And so the number one complaint that I received from the veterans that I represented was trying to navigate the VA bureaucracy or the distance that they had to travel to get to quality VA care. I think we've addressed that to an important extent in this new Mission Act, but I do have some concerns with it.
Hmm. Now, we just had two members of the Connecticut VFW on the air, and they're concerned that vets are not being consulted enough when it comes to input and future plans. Do they have valid concerns?
You know, they no, they don't, and they should be. You know, the VA should be consumer oriented, and before decisions are made either in the Congress or in a bureaucracy, there does need to be first and foremost consultation with the people that we're trying to serve. These are our clients. These are clients of the VA, and there should be greater outreach to them to measure and anticipate the impact of the changes that are being made bureaucratically and monetarily.
They're also very concerned about homelessness, a high suicide rate. You had mentioned some of those concerns, PTSD. Can we expand on that a bit? What should be done?
Yeah, look, it was staggering to me and shameful to me the extent and the magnitude of homelessness among veterans, and then add to that the horrible rate of suicides for people who are coming back from their deployments. I think before we figure out what to do about it, but you know, before we figure out what the prescription is, we need to understand what's led to these tragedies. A good part of it is, again, flippantly making decisions to go to war, not providing the support that's necessary. The operations pace, the operations tempo that we put our warriors through between Iraq and Afghanistan required not one deployment, but in some cases, multiple deployments. And so the burden of this war fell to these veterans. And by the way, 1% of the population of the United States of America is doing the defense and the fighting for the rest of the 99%. That is an unacceptable burden. So they have multiple deployments. They're stretched thin. They see the most grisly and horrific things. They come back, and they come back to a bureaucracy that's not prepared to provide them with the services they need in real time to respond to the crises that they face. And so, for example, I heard this horror story of veterans coming back from Afghanistan, from multiple deployments, Afghanistan and Iraq, going to a military hospital with psychiatric problems, being reticent to admit to those problems because there's still a horrible stigma attached to that, being diagnosed incorrectly, being handed a plastic bag filled with various medications and told to come back at another time. That is simply unacceptable. And so what we need to do is ensure that we are providing the highest quality care, that we're increasing resources of physicians, of nurses, of medical professionals, of psychiatrists and therapists and social workers, the entire integrated range of medical, mental health and physical health support services that these people deserve. If we do that, we'll be able to respond before a tragedy happens. We'll be able to deal with PTSD or a possible suicide in advance of it rather than have to catch up to it later.
Hmm. I just want to clarify one thing. When you say operations tempo, do you mean that it's too fast, that those are involved, who are involved don't have time to plan and recover?
Well, that's exactly right. So operations tempo is actually the tempo of military operations. So we go into, remember, we went into Afghanistan shortly after 9/11, the right thing to do in my view. And then within months, we decide, well, not only are we going to fight the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, but now we're going to stretch over to Iraq to stop Saddam Hussein from his WMD, Weapons of Mass Destruction program, which, by the way, he never had. And so now we're fighting on effectively two fronts in very fast-paced operations. And that pace, that tempo of kinetic conflict puts tremendous burdens on the people who are engaged in it and brings them back needing tremendously more services.
Mm. You brought up something interesting before about the medications for some of the vets nowadays, and I've had the good fortune to get to know some of the vets who served in World War II and in Korea, and I hope this doesn't come out in a flippant way, but they were a different breed. Many of these soldiers who I met had difficulties, but they would not discuss them. And they certainly wouldn't go for help, if you know what I mean. And it seems nowadays that some of the newer vets will acknowledge that, and they'll say, you know, I need a little assistance at this time.
Well, that's true, and I think I wouldn't say they're a different breed. I would say there was a greater reticence in the past to admit to the need for counseling and mental health services. Now I think there is a slightly greater willingness to reach out for help for two reasons. Number one, at the highest levels of leadership, PTSD was acknowledged. There was a general, very high-ranking general named General Hamm in Europe who did an article in Stars and Stripes where he disclosed that he was dealing with PTSD. So when you have, you know, the brass saying, it's okay, I'm dealing with it myself, and I want to tell you my story, that makes it easier for everybody else to tell the story. And the second reason, it was simply because of the numbers of people that we put on the battlefield in a compressed period of time with new technologies in different kinds of environments than we saw, for example, in World War II or even Vietnam. The volume of people and the kinds of things that they saw and the technologies that they deployed brought them back with, I would suggest, more intense needs. So the combination of a willingness to talk about it and the number of folks coming back from multiple deployments, I think, accentuated the issue. The problem we still have is, despite the progress that we've made in people talking about the issue, we are still not doing enough to help them with the issue.
Mm. Also, speaking with some of those VFW members, they expressed worry, concern that about the possible privatization of the VA in the future.
Yeah.
Is that something to be worried about?
Well, look, I'm concerned about it. Just as you probably know, Ron, over the past several weeks, legislation went into effect, and that's the VA Mission Act, which has a great intent, but we're going to need to watch its implementation to avoid a creep to privatization of VA services. And so the intent is to streamline those duplicative community care programs and give veterans more choices and greater control to the health care benefits that they earned. And to do that, we're now expanding beyond the traditional VA facilities, hospitals, and centers to private facilities. So, for example, a walk-in care facility, an urgent care facility. Now, these facilities need to be approved and enrolled in the plan, but it is an extension of the kind of conventional model of if you're a veteran and you need medical attention, you go to the VA hospital. The benefit of that is you will have more choices for veterans and more accessible choices. So in my case, I represented Long Island. We had the Northport VA, in my view, one of the better VA hospitals in the country. But, you know, if you're an 85-year-old veteran and you live on the east end of Long Island, getting to the Northport VA is not easy. And so now that 85-year-old veteran may be able to go to a recognized walk-in care clinic or a doctor's office and get the care they need. So the good news is more accessibility and more choice. What concerns me is that we not make this an entire shift to the privatization of the VA system. We want a VA system that's based on mission and not one that's based on corporate profit motive.
You're listening to The Full Story on WSHU, and we're speaking with former Congressman Steve Israel. And Congressman, you mentioned the Northport Veterans Affairs Medical Center. You were a member of the House's Veteran Affairs Committee. You held hearings about the center. What are your thoughts about the center today and how it's operating?
Yeah, I was a member, actually, of the Appropriations Subcommittee on Veterans Affairs, and that's the subcommittee that essentially signed the checks that allocated the resources to veterans facilities. And I was a frequent visitor to the VA hospital in Northport. Dedicated, committed physicians and nurses and staff. But one of those facilities that, despite its best efforts, suffered from misplaced priorities in Washington, D.C. Instead of providing more funding and investment to the Northport VA Hospital, we were funding tax cuts for the biggest gas, oil, drilling, and mining corporations in America. So to the extent that the VA Hospital in Northport and others struggled from time to time, it wasn't a lack of competence. It was a lack of commitment in Washington, D.C. and completely misplaced budgetary priorities.
So you think the center is much better today? Is it operating efficiently, up to your standards?
Look, I'm not sure that our VA program will ever be perfect. We just have to continuously make it better. The VA hospital in Northport did have some challenges. There were other hospitals, for example, in Phoenix, Arizona, that, in my view, were committing crimes with respect to waiting lists and not providing the care that was necessary. What's important is that we continue to make progress and to improve our veterans care by taking money away from those who don't really need it, like those big oil companies, and investing it in hospitals for veterans care that do need it.
I know we touched on this at the beginning of the conversation, and I know it's a bit of a philosophical question, but if I could expand on it a little bit more, why are we talking about this today? And I mean, if we ask vets to possibly give their lives to protect us, why isn't enough funding and resources allocated to take care of them?
Because a lot of people in Congress like to talk a good game, but then not back it up with the right investments. You know, when I'll never pretend to be the smartest member of Congress, although with some exceptions, the competition wasn't exactly that stiff. But I know my military history. I pride myself on my understanding of military history. And at the end of World War I, the Prime Minister of Great Britain said this. He said, "What is Britain's task? To make Britain a fit place for heroes to come home to." That is an obligation. That's the test of any society that from time to time goes to war. And it is shameful to me and angers me, quite honestly, that we fail that test. We develop the most exquisite precision technologies to kill people, and sometimes you have to do that in war. I get that. But then we kind of sit back and don't respond with the same technologies, innovation, commitment, and budgets for those who we deployed. This should not be a debate. This was my most frustrating the most frustrating aspect of my 16 years in Congress, that we would debate veterans' budgets. It was ridiculous. Now, in fairness, when the Democrats had the majority in the House of Representatives, they did pass the largest increase in VA health care in history. Now, Democrats and Republicans have passed some modernizations. We're on the right course, but we're just getting started.
So the two parties are, it sounds like you're saying that the two parties are coming together on this somewhat.
Yeah, look, when people say, is there any hope for bipartisanship in Washington, D.C., I often respond that if there is, it's going to be around our commitment to veterans. I don't think there's a Democratic or Republican way to provide care to a veteran with PTSD or any kind of injury. It's just the right thing to do. And as long as we have the right priorities, we can get there.
We have a minute left, and it's a sidebar, but I know that you have a new job. You're going to be spending some time in Ithaca, New York. What are you going to be doing?
I now direct the Cornell University Institute of Politics and Global Affairs, and what we do is we actually run what you and I did. We have conversations, and we raise the discourse, and we deepen people's understanding of national and international issues. And I'm based in New York City, and from time to time travel to Ithaca.
So you're doing your own talk show, are you?
I'm not as good as you are at it, but I'm doing the best effort I can.
Just what would be the number one if you were going to pick out a topic or two that you really wanted this new job to conquer and to talk about? What would it be?
Bipartisanship. How can we get Democrats and Republicans to agree on certain issues? If we can do that, then I will have achieved my mission.
Former Congressman Steve Israel, thank you, sir. I appreciate your time, and I hope we speak with you soon.
My pleasure.
That's it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is our digital editor. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen is the producer, and Lopez is the senior producer. And our news director is Terry Sheridan. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.